Your source for everything paranormal. Para-X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para-X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Merry meet, and blessed be, heed the words I call to thee. Honour the old ones in name and deed, hearken not to others' greed. Pray to the moon when she is round, luck with you shall then abound. Respect the earth, the sky, the sea, as you will it, so mote it be. Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron, on the Para-X Radio Network. And now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, Merry Meet everybody, and welcome to the show. Now, the opening music tonight was called Land of the Phantoms by Kevin MacLeod, and my guest, Christopher Bolzano, has transgressed many a land of phantoms. And since we're going to be talking about his podcast, Tripping on Legends, tonight, and talking about some of those legends, just kind of seemed to be an appropriate opener. Now, as he said in one of his recent Facebook posts, he's trekked through haunted woods and crossed ghostly bridges at midnight. He's searched for puckwidgies in the dark and stalked a monster by moonlight. But he's also a writer, a researcher, and has been documenting the unexplained since 1994. And I think the first interview I ever did with Chris was back in 2008 when he was one of my earliest guests, and we talked about his book, The Bridgewater Triangle. And tonight, as I said, we're going to be talking about some spooky legends, but we're also going to be talking about his new book, which is probably going to be released somewhere around Halloween, we guess. And there's a couple other things I'd like to talk about from that upcoming book. So in order to do that, though, Chris is going to need to carefully rip the duct tape off his mouth that we had to put on him and let his voice be heard. So quick rip, Chris, go for it.
Thank you. The tape is ripped much like my painting tape. What Marla didn't say about that post was that it actually was, I believe, in reference to me having to paint my bedroom, which I'm absolutely horrible at, and which is scarier than just about anything other than, you know, puckwudgies, I guess.
Yeah, that's where it came from. I saw that tape on that picture, and I thought, big brave hunter, and no, painting a bedroom. Ah! It's pretty funny.
No, I'm a pretty scary painter.
I'm glad I'm, 3,000 miles away from you, so I don't need to get spackled or anything. Yes, that would be good. I'm a smart witch. Anyway, you know, we've known each other forever, it seems like, but I don't remember ever asking you when your interest in ghosts and hauntings and all the rest began, or when lore and legends came into play. How about a little backstory?
Sure. I mean, growing up, it was always my obsession. You know, I always talk about how back in the day, my parents worked full time, and so the library was right next to the school, and that's where she picked me up, and so I spent all my time there, and I must have been about 11 before I made it up to the adult section, started reading Stephen King and the real horror type stuff. But while I was down in the basement in the kids' room, there were a few books that were about the unexplained, and I just devoured them. And then, of course, they got the Time Life books, and I devoured those. And so it was always in the back of my mind, and it always had influenced my fiction writing. I was always writing, you know, what I thought would be the best Twilight Zone episode or Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode. And then when I got to college at Emerson in Boston, in Kenmore Square, my dorm was one of the most haunted buildings in Boston. And I started just documenting what people were talking about. Like, okay, what did you experience? What did you experience? And the one thing I noticed was that having just read so much on not only ghosts, but ghost lore and folklore and urban legends, that a lot of what they were saying was going on in the dorm, or the backstory, I should say, more importantly, of what was going on, I had heard it before. I had heard it on other from other books or about other places, and I just started documenting it. And as I got out of college, it was really the beginning of the internet. So I was one of the first websites that focused solely on Massachusetts. And using the book New England Ghost Files, which anyone who's from New England knows about, I went out on my first legend trip. And part of it was looking into the Redheaded Hitchhiker of Route 44, which I won't get into too much. It's your typical Redheaded Hitchhiker type legend. And going to the place itself, I decided to write about it. And I decided to have a website that would focus on the hauntings. And then all of a sudden, having gone there, I was like, you know what? There really is kind of this, a whole bunch of other stories were developing about the Redheaded Hitchhiker that weren't part of the original text. And they were old stories. And I was like, you know, there's something about this crossroads between what is a real haunting and what are the stories that people make up about it, or people make up to explain it. And that's where I got the Crossroads, which have been with me for the last 20 years. You know, my first site was Massachusetts Paranormal Crossroads. I do everything under the umbrella now of Crossroads Media. And it really, I've noticed, having done this for, you know, going on 25 years, that we don't understand the unexplained at all. And we do the same thing with natural phenomenon that we do with supernatural phenomenon, which is we gravitate towards the most recognizable and often the most comforting backstory to explain it. And that's kind of where the paranormal and the folklore and the lore of it mesh for me.
I think, and I've said this before, but I think it's really important to have the history of places that we go and see and stuff, because it lends itself to maybe being a little bit more open-minded and makes things a little bit more interesting when you know kind of things that happen there or going around there. And you know, that right. Sometimes, you know, you get to a place and you get a certain feeling and you don't know where it came from. But sometimes if you know, and I'm not saying that we have to know the history of every place, because that spoils investigations, because it kind of leads you into going by what you've read before. So, you know, you have to be careful about what you know before you go in there, as you know. But just having to know that some place was, you know, occupied by Native Americans or whatever, 100 years ago, 300 years ago, and you get that feeling, you might understand why you got that feeling or where it's coming from, that kind of thing. So, yeah.
I think it's important for us to kind of lay out for your audience right now what I do, because I've done the investigation route. I've done the investigator route. As more and more people were communicating with me via my website, I felt the need to investigate more. And then, of course, people would contact me about their houses, things like that. And I did that for a really long time.
Yeah.
And then it just became too much. And it wasn't where I had started from, and it wasn't interesting to me anymore, that part of it. And so what I do now, and you can tell from the show name a little bit, Tripping on Legends, is I legend trip. So for me, when I go to a location, I not only want to know everything about the location and the stories that people are saying about it, but I want to know what I can do that is part of that. You know, like what is it at a certain location that people have experienced so that I can go and experience it. So I completely, toss off the investigator hat. That's not me anymore. And what I do is I try to experience what's going on. And oftentimes, by doing research into the background of it, I try to find what might trigger the experience that other people have had and go and do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you have you noticed that, I mean, we're going back years, but have you noticed that everybody, not everybody, but a great number of people that we hung out with and investigated with and had on our shows and everything stepped out of that at some point as well? I think all of the investigators kind of are going a little bit different routes, whether it's historical. I mean, my show's gone more metaphysical.
Right.
We don't talk to teens and things like that. So it just seems like so many have been there, done that, and are moving on to something in the same genre, obviously, but not in the same way.
Yeah, I think that to a large degree, from people I've spoken to, and definitely my path, my journey, science will always fail you. And while it gives you a sense that you're actually really doing something out there because you're being active and you're gathering information and you're going through a process, even when you get the best evidence you can possibly get, either A, no one believes you, or B, you're left still shrugging your shoulders at what it all means. Mm-hmm. I think that's played itself out, and part of the kind of new twist that people are putting on things is because ultimately investigating, and obviously there's an element of it that helps people, but for the most part, it's really kind of empty, and people feel that they keep collecting all this information, but they're not doing anything with it, and it doesn't get them any closer to the truth. But when you start to look at the historical aspect of it, and when you start to look at the metaphysical aspect of it, mm-hmm. you can see the paranormal as part of us, and therefore it becomes our story as opposed to something we're trying to solve or prove to people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we all know that trying to prove it never works, right?
You know, I always say this, but I got to say it. Assume every interview is someone listening to me for the first time. When I wrote, and this was an investigation book, right? Mm-hmm. When I wrote Picture Yourself Ghost Hunting, mm-hmm. I asked dozens of paranormal investigators, why are you doing this? And a lot of them said to help, but a lot of them, like the vast majority of them said to prove something, right? Yeah. To prove that ghosts exist. I asked further on in the questionnaire, what do you think will convince someone who doesn't believe in ghosts that they'll believe in ghosts? And every single person who filled out that questionnaire said nothing but their own personal experience.
There you go. Yeah.
And it's like, well, don't you think that's a paradox then? You're doing this to prove it to people, but you're in the same breath saying nothing will prove it to them until they've experienced something themselves. And so I really hold that to be true. And I think that it took a while after the kind of newness and the kind of sensationalism of investigating had kind of played itself out for people to realize that it's much more about the heart of a haunting. It's much more about what it means to you. And it's a lot more about, you know, having the experience rather than trying to capture the experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's so many, the five W's, who, what, where, when, and why. I mean, a lot of questions are in front of you to answer. But some people don't need to know all five things. They need to know one to be convinced, or, it's everybody's an individual. So it's really kind of fascinating. But the thing about proving to me, it's just my opinion. It's never going to be proved. I mean, prove it to yourself. You can talk yourself into it. You can believe it. I don't mean talk yourself into it because it's not real, but real to you. But you can't ever convince anybody anything that they don't believe in. You know, you have the skeptics and you have the cynics. Skeptics,
you know, my father.
Good. Yeah.
My father had a paranormal experience. He and my mother in the house we used to live in. It never happened to me when I was there, but it happened to them, of an old woman in white appearing to them. Mm-hmm. And it happened, the majority of it was after I had moved out. And both of them experienced it, and both of them kind of had their own mindset of what it might have been. But if you ask my father to this day, he'll tell you the details of the story. He'll mm-hmm. say how she disappeared into the wall. And yet if you say, was it a ghost? He's like, no, it wasn't a ghost. Well, what was it? Nah, who knows? Mm-hmm. Okay, but you just said all this stuff happened and she was there. Yeah, man, you know, it wasn't a ghost. Like, so even people who have their own personal experience often deny it, you know, and often yeah. put it through a filter that will always put it through a filter that they are comfortable with. And for my father, as an example, he's comfortable with it being nothing. But he yeah, doesn't even offer. He's not like Scrooge and says it was a, you know, he ate something bad that day. He just legitimately says, like, yeah, it happened. But okay, mm-hmm. so what was it? Yeah, who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Got a question in the chat room. You probably see it too, but from Cece. Do you think the recent emphasis on everything is demonic is turning researchers away from investigations?
I think it's a dual-edged sword. I think that, you know, to acknowledge something demonic is to acknowledge the metaphysical, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's really kind of confusing to say you're going to approach it from a scientific place and then say, but we think it's demonic. You know, and I understand that that's what sells, right?
Sure.
That people want it to be spooky and they want it to be, and they want it to tie into movies that they've seen and things like that. And mm-hmm. I think, it's not that I don't think that there are elemental things that kind of present themselves as demonic, mm-hmm. but I don't think it's turning researchers away from the paranormal as much as it's turning people off or taking people in the paranormal seriously.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the reason that a lot of people are staying away from investigations, the old investigators, the ones that were really in it for the right reasons back then and knew what they were doing and whatever, I just think they got pushed away from all those wannabes who thought they knew it all because they watched Most Haunted. And you know, no offense to Most Haunted, but you know what I mean. A lot of people thought that they were going to get a bad name from people that, you know, thought they were perfect and knew
right.
it all.
You know, it would be absolutely silly to say that paranormal television has had no impact on the paranormal, right?
Okay,
I think it creates the way that people view who are experiencing the paranormal, the way they view it, because mm-hmm. they've been able to now see it on television or they've watched it. It definitely yeah. has influenced investigators because there weren't that many out there before them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also influenced those people who were into the paranormal and were looking into it before then, because mm-hmm. now we have a measuring stick to go by, right? And mm-hmm. people automatically assume that we are a certain way when yeah. we're doing it. You know, I still have it. It's funny. My kids are on a ghost tour right now, three states away.
Uh-huh.
And they still, when the person on the tour asked them, does anyone here believe it? They said, our dad's a paranormal investigator. Even though I constantly tell them I'm not a paranormal investigator, like, mm-hmm. they're like, he's a ghost hunter. I'm like, I do not, I've never hunted ghosts. but I think that it created
bragging rights.
And the other impact was that it created a very loud noise that people who were genuine had to compete with. And I think that having to do that competition and having to conform to a certain idea, I think that sullied a lot of people to looking into ghosts the way that they did it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's so many changes, but I think what's happening is for the better, because we're opening more horizons. You know, people that might not believe in hauntings or ghosts or demons might believe in other things metaphysical. So I think one door opened the other. And I mean, honestly, witches are now being way more accepted than once upon a time, and people know that we just don't come out in Halloween. So, you know, the more you get into a bigger variety of things, people have more to think about and gravitate to those particular things that interest them instead of just one thing. You know, you're going to go out and you know, do this because somebody else is doing it.
Right, and one of the things that's kind of evolved on Tripping on Legends is we allow the locations that we go to to influence us as storytellers and to influence the way that we look at things. And so one of the dramatic turns we've taken in the last 2 years since a very specific experience is at these locations that we go to looking for things like fairy rings or fairy trees. Mm-hmm. And incorporating this idea, which a paranormal investigator, a ghost hunter would never want to bring that into things. And even, you know, someone who's looking into hauntings, like, no, I want my ghost to be straight. I want it to be easily explained, you know, and mm-hmm. we're saying, well, the weird thing is we're finding in a lot of these places are these fairy rings. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the hauntings seem to be connected to these other unexplained things. And so for us to completely ignore that and not bring that into the conversation spits in the face of thousands of years of folklore, mm-hmm. as well as what we're seeing in front of our eyes.
Exactly. And the first time I got my website and put up a blog page, I think the second blog was called Never Step in a Fairy Ring. And I thought that, you know, most of the people that would go to my website might be ghosty people or witchy people or something. But that blog got more readings probably than any of the other ones I've ever done, because it hit somebody's imagination and curiosity.
Right. And I think that it's, you know, to say you are going to look to explain something and then avoid a potential explanation for that, or mm-hmm. at least the context of someplace you are, kind of only gives people a partial picture. You should be looking at what are other things that say it. If it's a ghost, it's a ghost. It's historical, we want to look at that. If it's potential fairy rings or elementals, we want to look at that because it really gives the full picture. And as storytellers, you have to keep in mind, as a legend tripper, I look for the experience and I look for the story behind it. The mm-hmm. truth of it is irrelevant to me, only what people feel to be true. And so if part of that is this very strong belief that people have had for centuries about fairies or elementals, to ignore that as part of the narrative of a location is silly to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It doesn't make any sense at all. And you talk about a lot of things on Tripping the Legends. I mean, you did a show on graveyard etiquette, haunted schools, shadow people, ghostly dreams. I mean, you're going across the board on all these different topics, which is really, really good. It opens people's
eyes. Well, I think that, you know, what we were trying to do when we were much more consistent is we would try to put out an episode about a location every week, every other week. And then every other week, we would do a live show talking about kind of the folklore within the paranormal field. So, you know, for example, what is the folklore behind a Ouija board? It wasn't necessarily looking at a location, but we were looking into that. Or what is the folklore behind haunted schools in general? Or like you're saying, we did a whole one on graveyard etiquette because we had been doing several legend trips and we're like, are we doing graveyards the way that people should be? And what is the folklore people are telling? Not mm-hmm. just about a specific one we might go to, but in general, what are people saying about it? And so, you know, we were hoping that that would help to educate. As a middle school teacher, you know, that's always in the back of my mind as I have to teach people.
Mm-hmm.
But also, you know, to understand this kind of, you know, when a haunting happens, so when you have a haunted cemetery or someplace that people think is haunted, it's really the experience that someone's had there. But more often than not, it's all the backstory of every cemetery that's ever been said in a ghost story that is influencing the person who's telling you that or who has the experience even. The same way they watch television shows, they've been listening and learning about ghost lights since they were very little, right? They've been hearing what happens in a cemetery. And so, you know, we feel like we need to throw that stuff out there to give people a complete picture.
Yeah. I think that's, you know, the best way to go. Because that way you do it, it's something for everybody. People don't care about the history.
Right.
Okay. They don't care about the other part, but there's always something that they're going to sit down and listen to and say, wow, okay. You know, maybe they won't admit learning from it because you know how people are, but they probably did. And it just makes it so much more interesting. I mean, well, that's the thing too. I mean, you're a teacher and I've seen some of the notes that you write and posts on Facebook. You don't teach with a lot of dogma. I mean, you're very open-minded about the way you teach. You know, okay, I think this is a better way of saying it. You teach without people really knowing that they're learning, which is the best way possible, right?
Unfortunately, a lot of people would say I teach without anyone actually learning. So
I see it the other way.
Yeah, like, you know, and that's really tough to do, you know, mm-hmm. that, and this is a whole different show altogether, but, you know, it's really tough to do, but, you know, one of the things that I try to do is just influence, get them to think critically about this, you know, mm-hmm. And to do that, you have to keep an open mind. And so I try to expose them to as much as I can. And I try to do the same thing in the paranormal as well. Like, you know, you can look at, you know, something like Robert. And I think that Robert the Doll has had a narrative, at least for the last 15, 20 years, that has been pretty consistent to the point that elements of his story have become backstory, but really they might actually be, you know, the nature of Robert the Doll as opposed to just being kind of like the context for him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we're going to get deeper into Robert after the break, and we still have a couple of minutes because Robert deserves.
That was me trying to do a really cute segue.
I know, and I blew it for you. Yeah, I know. See, two show hosts together.
Okay,
bang heads. No, because I mean, really, we're going to have a break, so we don't have enough time. But yeah, I got myself out of that one. but it's just. One question, too, that kind of, you know, because we're going to be talking about, after the break, we're also going to be talking about your book, Florida's Haunted Love Stories, and we'll get into that. But the question that goes along with that is, you know, you're from the Upper East Coast. You've written about the Bridgewater Triangle and Darkwoods, for example. How did you decide to head down south to do a book on Florida?
I live in Florida.
You do? Oh, okay. Okay. Stupid question. Bad research. Go.
No, that's okay. That's okay because I think I'm so associated with New England and I.
Yeah, you are.
My posts even now are mostly about Massachusetts and Boston as opposed to where I am.
Yep.
But I moved down here about 11 years ago. So I was trying to promote the Bridgewater Triangle about as far away from the Bridgewater Triangle as you can go.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, unlike some like Ron Kolick, you do know how to pronounce your R's too, which is, you know, awfully strange to somebody.
First of all, I pronounce things a lot better than Ron right across the board. Don't even try to get him to say Pukwudgie. But I also live in my official radio voice, so if I get angrier or talk faster, you'll hear my accent come out more.
Really? Okay, because then I must never have upset you at all because I've never heard that come out of your mouth. And you know, you don't call me Marler. Wait a minute. Mahler. So, the R goes on the end. The R in the middle gets taken away completely. Yes. But we love Ron.
Well, I've known Ron for about 20 years, and he still mispronounces my name, so.
The Balzano part or the Chris?
Both.
Okay.
It's part of his charm.
Yeah, I know. Well, he is very charming. I love him. But anyway, okay, so that was it. I mean, that puts Florida back in perspective now because did you get tired of being up north or I mean why'd you move down?
That's way too long of a story for us to get into.
All right, okay.
But you know, it essentially came down to, you know, a money kind of situation. But you know, when I got here for years, partly because I was still promoting books from New England,
mm-hmm.
And partly just my ignorance and being in a very generic part. I live in Southwest Florida, Fort Myers.
Mm-hmm.
It is just the east, but in the south. So most of the people are not born here. And so I really thought that this area had no lore for me to look into. You know, it was all pretty recent. And then kind of once I got that bias aside, in the last couple of years, I've discovered that it is actually a pretty rich battleground here for these great ghost stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's such a great history back there that you can pick and choose so many different things. I mean, I don't know a whole lot about it, but even getting into the Robert the Doll subject and, you know, having read the backstory on him and stuff, I'm like, wow, who knew about the pirates? And who knew that, you know, where he's now housed used to be kind of like a fort and, you know, kind of things. I mean, it was really kind of interesting because you always think of Florida is like palm trees and beaches and, you know, that's about it.
Right,
you know.
Right. And one of the things you don't realize is that, you know, the Native American influence in Florida is as strong as it is in other parts of the country. Then you have the French, then you have the Spanish, then you have America, then you have the Seminole Wars, then you have the transplants. And so it really is this kind of ripping away of history and rewriting it by the next people that come in. Mm-hmm. And what that makes for is a really rich folklore kind of background of things, where you actually can track and trace where things have changed. Because, okay, well, then the French came in and they did this, and then also when the Spanish came in, now they're telling a completely different story. And so, you know, it's actually interesting that way, because it's been wiped out and rewritten so many times that mm-hmm. actually makes for some really good research.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right, well, we're going to take this break that I threatened everybody with a minute ago, and so we'll be back in 2 minutes.
Don't go away. There's more Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks right after these important messages.
Rhett, where are you going?
I'm going back to the paranormal view, back where I belong.
Please, take me with you.
No, I'm through with everything here. I want to see if there's something left in life I haven't explored. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, Rhett, don't run to them. They talk about ghosts and hauntings, UFOs, and all kind of supernatural scary stuff.
You'll never understand, will you, Scarlet?
No!
Well, that's your misfortune.
Rhett, if you go, where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear...
Line!
Oh, you gotta be kidding.
That's The Paranormal View with your host, Henry Foister, Jeffrey Gould, and Barbara Duncan. Every Saturday night at 8 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on the Para-X Radio Network. Missed an episode of Stirring the Cauldron? Then be sure to check out MarlaBrooks.com and check out the archive. And while you're there, check out Marla's weekly Witch's Oracle card reading. Explore the site to find many great resources, such as information on tarot, oracle readings, metaphysical consultations, and links to all of Marla's books. That's MarlaBrooks.com. Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
I love it when people say, and we're back, as if nobody would know that if I started talking. But we are back with Christopher Bolzano, and we're talking about his books and his show, Tripping on Legends. And I want to talk, and this is a reason, Kristen, you know this, that I got in touch with you originally, was to talk about the witch hunt you went on, kind of.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, ostensibly, that's kind of what it was. And so let's talk about Arbuckle Creek and the witch.
Sure. First, I'd like to say happy birthday, because I didn't start with that. Sorry about that.
Oh, shit. It's done. I'm forgetting it now.
But
yeah.
Not too far.
Thank you.
So we had heard about this haunting at Arbuckle Creek in Lorda, Florida. So that's not a misprint. It's Lorda beginning with an L, Florida. And the backstory of it was that a man wanted to buy a love potion. So he contacted a woman in town who, for all intents and purposes, was a witch, although the community didn't use that word. And when he got to the bridge to purchase it, she said the fee was going to be his firstborn child. And this angered him so much that they got into a fight. He ended up throwing her from the bridge, impaling her on a cypress tree that was coming out of the water. And even though the story doesn't say this, we believe taking the love potion and you know, leaving town. So he buried the body. I shouldn't say he buried. He weighed the body down in the swamp. And she came back, and she still is known to be seen on that bridge, and people have been reporting this for 50 years at least, that they see this old woman on the bridge. And then the more we dug into it, people were also seeing these two figures on the bridge as well, like these two male figures, one younger, one older, which we present as being the firstborn child and the man who made the deal, like somehow they're trapped there as well.
Good point.
And so, you know, we went to the bridge, and I think at the beginning of it, we were taking it a little bit lighthearted. We were seeing it as, we were really playing up the witch angle. We were seeing it as an opportunity for us to explore folklore about witches and deals with witches. And then, you know, coming from New England, witches really being pacts with the devil. And the more research we did, and the more I reached out to my favorite witch, Marla Brooks, the more it started to change for us. By the time we got there, we saw this much more of a case of a murder victim. You know, murder victim being found, and that's the way that we wanted to approach it, as opposed to getting too spooky with the witch aspect of it. Mm-hmm. In preparation for it, because this is what we do with Tripping on Legends, we decided to make our own love potion. So after consultation with you, and kind of some stuff I found online that I think fit other parts of the folklore behind this, we went to the bridge, we set up a circle the way that you had taught me, set our incantation, and tried to get the witch to communicate with us, not as a witch, but as a person who is a victim of a crime.
Right.
You know, and it's really interesting because we had experiences while we were there, and yet we also came to believe that this was a story that people had come up with to explain something that was happening on the bridge, yes, but also to kind of explain away the bad stuff that were happening in the town itself. It's a town, essentially, that around the time that the legend came about, it started to fail. It's actually a ghost town now, for the most part. And so, you know, them going out and having to burn the witch's house, which is what they did once they started to see her on the bridge, to try to exorcise her from the location, really seemed as if it were very Puritan, right? Like, go and, you know, bad stuff's going on, bad stuff's happening, we've got to purge the witch and then everything will be good. And so, you know, like a lot of our legend trips and kind of what we do, we discovered that, like, there's a historical aspect to it and a community aspect to it, as well as this kind of ghostly aspect to it.
Yeah, and you know, when people go, oh, it's witch things, somehow they think of witches as beings other than human. And, you know, I mean, most of us, I can't account for everybody, but most of us, you know, have red blood and we came into this world the right way and you know, take out the garbage and do lots of mundane things too. So, you know, but witch still has that connotation that it's really spooky and that we're supernatural beings. And okay, in some ways, maybe we are a little bit, but, you know, people's impression, when you say witch, boy, you're going to get that whole thing that's been going on for thousands of years, and it's not completely right, because I think we're being seen more as human beings these days, but, you know, beforehand,
right.
I mean, Jesus.
Right. But not when these stories are kind of getting formed, right? And so we've actually looked into several different cases of witches and witches as the kind of source of these hauntings. And in almost every single one that we find, we see some kind of whitewashing of what a community did as opposed to someone who had any kind of weird supernatural powers. Not that you're not powerful, Marla.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
It's very important to mention that. but yeah, no, it's true. And people just, they have to, again, be sort of educated. They have to see what's going on. They have to understand and you know, not believe what you hear from everybody else. Make your own judgment. Find out for yourself what you think and what you feel, rather than being the sheep. And
with that said, when you're looking into it from a folklore aspect, you can't ignore that that's the way that people feel, you know, or that's the way that people felt, at least. And so you have to kind of look at that. And like I said, we were even kind of caught up in the witchiness of it before, I mean, to hours before we got there. By the time I think that we drove out there, even we had talked about it as like, you know what, this is, if this backstory is true, if there's any element of it that's true, what this really is a man who murdered someone and him being called to pay for his crimes. Just in a very similar way, we came across another witch kind of oriented legend in Hog Island, out near Tampa. And in this case, it was said that this woman was a witch, that she had She had, you know, committed these crimes of witchcraft, and the community decided to put her to death. Even though there's really not a lot of reports of witch trials or that kind of thing in Florida, we're finding more and more cases that are like this. Mm-hmm. And what we found, given the context of other hauntings and other haunted locations that are right near there, not to mention the really dark history of the town itself, mm-hmm. that this was most likely the lynching of a black man or a black woman mm-hmm. for being black. But over time, they couldn't deal with that. That was too real, right? It was a lot, in some weird way, it was a lot easier to say the community had put a witch to death mm-hmm. than the fact that what we were actually seeing was potentially the haunting of someone who had been lynched at that same exact location.
Yeah. Well, witches have always made good scapegoats. So, you know, that it makes good sense.
Yeah.
They would do that. Yeah. You know what? I want to talk about the book. Because in addition to the show, you've got the new book coming out, and it's called Florida's Haunted Love Stories. Now, when I was listening and doing my
title.
You changed it?
Well, I don't think the publisher is going to want to go with another one. They kind of like that one.
Okay.
But so that's what we're going to go with for now. Hashtag.
Okay.
Hashtag. Florida's Haunted Love Stories.
Okay. Now, but you made a really good video the other day, last week or something.
Thank you.
About Tripping Legends. And you mentioned that haunted love stories isn't exactly romantic love as it may sound. And you broke it up into three categories. And so why don't you take it from there?
Sure. And I'm not sure if the book's going to play this out in terms of like being sections of the book that are like this, because there's too mm-hmm. much intermixing between these. Like there's a location that might have more than one.
Mm-hmm.
But the three that I'm really focusing on are romantic love. And you see a lot of that. And so for people who don't really get the angle that I'm going at, if you look into so many ghost stories that people have told, so many of them have an origin that's based in love.
Mm-hmm.
And the great example I always give is you know, someone who, for one reason or another, loses someone that they love, and so they take their lives, and so now their ghost is seen always jumping from the same place that they jumped from because they couldn't find their love, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or something like a mother loses her children, and she returns to that location over and over again, still trying to find her kids after all these years.
Mm-hmm.
And so the three big categories that I came up with were romantic love, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then love for family.
Mm-hmm.
And at least in one of the locations, that extends to the brotherhood of the military. You know,
mm-hmm.
like feeling that family-type bond between soldiers, or
mm-hmm.
in this case, airmen.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third one is this kind of love of duty. And this would be the category where, for example, you love something so much that you constantly return to it. It becomes obsession. Or you love your job so much that you continue to go to work even after you die, which is a horrible idea to think of, right? That you're trapped
mm-hmm.
for eternity
yeah.
doing your job.
Yeah.
But what these are cases where people genuinely loved what they did and they can't stop doing it. And so, for example, for those, we have a few that involve college dorms. For example, at UF, there is the ghost of someone who used to work the cafeteria decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was always known for being loud. Old Steve was his name. And he was always known for being loud and being in the back, kind of, you know, yelling at things and smashing pots and pans. And after he died, people continued to hear him yelling. And they continued to hear, even after it stopped being a kitchen, people continued to hear pots and pans being slammed around and things like that. So
mm-hmm.
that's a case where love for what you do may have actually caused you to continue on after your own death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, we all have had investigations. We all hear that stuff. But one of the things that, let me see, it was really important a minute ago. Oh, yeah.
How's that effect on?
No, yeah, well, yeah. No, when I was, we were going to talk about love, where does Robert the Doll fit in? Which category does he fit in?
I think that, you know, I have a different take on Robert than some people. And it fits in. The chapter on Robert is called, you know, Two Cases of Obsession. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the story of a lighthouse keeper who continues to go and to work the lighthouse. And the other is the case of this doll, which people have put all kinds of stories into and all kinds of beliefs into. And what often gets overlooked is that it all begins with the obsession of a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it all, for yep. people who don't know the story, that Robert was given to a young boy who almost immediately changed his name to his middle name, Gene or Eugene. And he carried this doll around everywhere he went. He put all his love into this doll. And at some point, the doll seemed to take a life of its own, to the point that there are reports that even as an adult, Eugene would be seen walking the streets of Key West, still holding the doll,
mm-hmm.
you know, and eventually his wife told him he had to keep it up in the attic. He had to put it away. And that led to a lot of heartbreak and that kind of obsession might have been enough to inspirit the doll.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been enough to draw something else into it. But whatever it is, Robert the doll has been, I always call him the paranormal superstar. You know, mm-hmm. this is one of the big cases involving haunted objects. So I covered it in my book, Haunted Objects. I revisit it in a different way in the new book. But it is one of these things where people go crazy for Robert the doll.
Mm-hmm.
It's said to be the inspiration for Chucky, but I've also found like that that's not the case. And, you know, I've been to visit him a few times. One time, unintentionally, we were at a conference together, and I didn't know who he was. I didn't know who Robert the Doll was yet. I had just moved to Florida, and mm-hmm. I pretty much avoid the paranormal media in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And so I never really heard about Robert the Doll too much. I was much more familiar with Annabelle, you know, from having been in New England and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And people kept asking me to take a picture of them with this doll. And I thought it was just a creepy doll, that it was, you know, and I'm like, oh, okay, it must be some kind of haunted doll. I know, you know, those exist.
Mm-hmm.
And people were obsessive about him. And they would give me the camera. And I was wondering why they kept saying to me, take a picture. And then I take a picture. And they say, okay. Now ask to take a picture and take it again. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I don't know, not knowing that there are Robert's rules. So when you go and visit Robert, for example,
mm-hmm.
you must say hello when you come in. You must ask to take his picture. You must thank him for allowing you to take the picture. And you must say goodbye to him when you leave. And if you don't do those, there's a potential you could die.
Yeah.
And so for anyone who's never seen pictures of Robert in his casing down there in Key West, what is behind him is an entire wall covered with letters from people who say, Robert, I'm sorry, I didn't show you the respect that you deserved while I was there. I didn't say goodbye, and I got into a car accident right after I left.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, my plane was delayed, or, you know, we lost our lug. All these horrific things that happened, some big, not some not, that mm-hmm. people attribute to having disrespected the doll.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really this kind of phenomenon that you can't pinpoint what exactly it is about Robert that makes him haunted.
Mm-hmm.
We can only kind of speculate, you know, and look at all these different causes of what might potentially have done it.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating thing. I mean, the doll, the way people take it, the legends that have built up around Robert, as you said, about asking if you could take their pictures and take a picture and say hello and goodbye and all those people. I mean, it just spun out from the love of a kid to its doll. And of course, if people don't know, they said that Robert was given to Eugene from somebody that worked in the house who was doing voodoo or something. So she had put a spirit in there from day one.
Right. One of the backstories, which I totally embrace as a folklorist, but which totally isn't true, is that it was given by one of the servants,
mm-hmm.
One of the African-American servants who was well-skilled in voodoo, and that she, a little time later, was fired.
Mm-hmm.
And then when she was fired, she decided to curse the doll. Yeah. Chances are, and I hate doing this, but this is what Tripping on Legend is, chances are that's not the story at all, that his grandfather brought it back from Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But still, the other story is so much better.
Yeah, of course. Yes, I mean, there's, and I like the story too, that when Eugene's wife forced him to keep Robert up in the attic, there was a chair by the window where Robert sat, supposedly to look out. And people swear they saw him jump out of the chair and run around the room. I love that thing. You know, that right. My head is so cute. Because if anybody knows just, what Robert looks like.
I am drinking right now out of my Robert Did It coffee cup as we talk.
Wow.
And it really becomes this case of Robert mania. Like, there are so many different stories that it's really hard to separate what might have happened from what didn't happen. Yeah. And so the best thing you could do is not do that, right? Like, just embrace all of the different stories, and that way you have this kind of fun, interesting, intriguing, spooky picture rather than trying to make sense out of it, because you can't make sense out of it.
No, and you're never going to know. And sometimes it's so heartening when there's a colorful story. I mean, you know, seeing Robert in my mind's eye running, yoo-hoo, in the room, looking out the window and waving at people, cracked me up. I mean, it gave me a really good feeling. That's not to say maybe he did, you know, maybe he did. But my imagination took it to another level, and I absolutely love that part of it. You know, it's like, yay, Robert. So,
you know, and it's funny because when we were down in Key West a few years ago, for something non-paranormal related, but of course we can't go anywhere without Tripping, right?
Mm-hmm.
We went to the artist's house, which is the house that he was kept in. Mm-hmm. And we were actually the first people to be up in the attic since he was removed. And it's interesting that part of the story is also kind of left out, you know, and I understand it because, you know, you really want Robert himself to be haunted.
Yeah.
But after talking with the guy who owns it, it's now Ben Breakfast, for talking with him, getting him to warm up, which took quite a while, you get that there's still weird things that go on, and that there's still Robert's footsteps being heard in the attic, and that you know, there's a lot going on that people don't understand, and that there was, you know, when they moved him, some weird stuff went on as well, where, like, you know, they weren't allowed to physically remove him, they couldn't get it out, and the things that they were using to try to, you know, it seems like it's a small thing, you go and you take a doll, but, like, they couldn't open the door, for example, and you don't know how much of that is true and how much of that is hype. But the good thing about legend tripping as opposed to investigating is I don't care what's true and what's not. It all makes the story.
Yeah, and that's the
as long as you approach it from that perspective, you know, that there are things about Robert that, you know, have developed over years that are as interesting to embrace as long as you don't you understand that it's not fact, that a lot of it is lore.
Mm-hmm. Lore is beautiful. History is beautiful. And it's, I don't know, some people say, oh, I hate history. I just, you know, and lore is just a bunch of lies made up, and, you know, they want the black and white. They live in the black and white. They don't want to jump into those gray areas that are probably, in some cases, the most interesting. You know,
and I also think those who base themselves in science need to take a step back in terms of paranormal. Take a step back and realize that you're basing your ideas on the paranormal about lore. You know, that foundation is in lore. So when you think of something like a cold spot signifies a ghost, that's really something that has no scientific basis. Mm-hmm. It has a folklore basis, and now you're checking on it scientifically. Because I've heard they cause cold spots and they cause hot spots, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, and I posted this week about ghost lights and cemeteries and gas and how we've been led to believe this certain idea about, you know, gas being released from graves is what causes ghost lights, and it's not the paranormal at all, and we should discredit anything that's like, and yet no one could really give me a good explanation for A, why that's true, and B, how does that account for all the different variables, such as cemeteries that have been in existence for hundreds of years still having them? Or why are some different sizes, and why are they different colors? And I posted it knowing that I have several people who are scientists who are, you know, on my friend list, and really no one could come up with an answer for that. And so it's important to understand that if you are someone who likes the black and white of things, you have to understand that many times that black and white is actually based on a lot of gray. And just over time, people have kind of made it more solid, but it usually isn't.
Exactly. All right, we're running out of time, but I want you to let people know where they can find some of the archives from Tripping on Legends and,
sure.
and the live show, too.
Anywhere where you can get podcasts. So if you are an Apple Play or you are an iTunes person, which I guess is the same thing. If you're on Google Play, if you're on iTunes, just type in Tripping on Legends and you can find it. Probably one of the best places for you to go is on Facebook. Like, our Facebook is probably the most active thing that we do because we're posting ghost stories, but also what we do and interesting things. And that's facebook.com/trippingonlegend. And then where I post a lot of my writing, although I've been not posting it because I've been actually writing the book for the past few weeks, finishing up the book, is at www.trippingonlegends.wordpress.com. So it's a WordPress site. So those are the three best places. But chances are, if you just type Christopher Balzano into a search engine, you're going to have a lot more of me than you want.
Oh, there's never too much of you. And once they can all also write, because Puckwudgies were your thing not your thing for a long time, but you were known on my show from all those years as the Puckwudgie guy.
I can take a step back now and say, without being arrogant, that I am the person who brought Puckwudgies to the forefront of people's knowledge. I didn't invent them. I just was the first person to report on them in depth, which got me the nickname, the Puckwudgie guy. But as a folklorist, I can sit back and say, wow, it's really amazing that they've kind of launched and they're all different variants and things like that. Mm-hmm. And no one ever mentions me when they talk about them. But that's okay, because, you know, it's kind of I never owned the legend itself. It's just something that I talked about a lot. So, Right. Yeah, if you want to know about Puckwudgies, you can definitely contact me as well.
Okay. Well, thank you. And you know what? You need to come back sooner than 10 years, okay? Is that a deal?
Yeah. When the book actually comes out, I'd love to come on and we can talk about some of the other great legends that I cover in the book.
You got it. You got it. Just holler at me and we'll set you up. And so
sounds
I also I want to thank everybody that's in the chat room. The chat room is pretty full. There's elbow room only, but that's very cool. But we need people in there, otherwise we're talking to ourselves. So thank you guys in chat. Thank you, Christopher. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Please join us again next week at the same time for another great guest and more Cauldron Stirring. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without explicit permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2019. The Mysterioso March by Kevin MacLeod is licensed through Incompotech.com.